Welcome to Ojibwe Stories, Gaga Nunanada. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. Our guest today is Brian McGinnis, Assistant Professor of Education at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Today, Brian talks about his latest book project, Between the Lines, a biography of his great-grandfather, Francis Pegamagabo, an Ojibwe man many times decorated as a World War I soldier. McGinnis's book contains many of Pegamagabo's own stories as retold through the voices of his children. I wonder, before we get started, if you could talk about where you're from and kind of situate us geographically.
Sure, yeah. Miigwech, thank you. Thank you, Eric. Bujo to all of our relatives, Anin, Ninsa, Wabishke Makwa, Indishinikas, Wasoxing, Ishkuniganing, Wenjibayan. So my name is Brian McGinnis. My Ojibwe name is Wabishke Makwa. It's a white, silver-colored bear. And I am from the Wasoxing community in Georgian Bay of Lake Huron, towards the eastern side of the Great Lakes.
Can you give us from Duluth, a rough drive time?
Yeah.
That's one of the things, too, I think, for Ojibwe people from our part of the world, just how vast Ojibwe territory really is. So tell us about your latest book project.
What essentially I've been working with is it's an oral history project, and it's about the life of my great-grandfather. His name was Francis Pegamagabo, and that's about it as Ojibwe a last name as you're going to get. He continues to be the most decorated First Nations Aboriginal Canadian soldier in history. He was one of the very first recruits in the First World War, which, of course, as we know, is just in that 100th year, I guess, memorial of that event. And his story has been a pretty fascinating story, almost like an urban legend of sorts over the years. And so, you know, his life has just been surrounded in a great deal of tragedy and mystery, but yet also incredible triumph. So I wanted to explore that story, learn more about him while there was opportunity to. And there was just such interest in his life. And I had done some, you know, research earlier in my life about him. So it just seemed to be the time to bring all of that forth.
Can you talk a little bit about the structure of your book and how you use these different, particularly the Ojibwe stories that you talk about?
Sure, yeah. The book project is called Between the Lines, The Stories of Francis Pegamagabo. And I think the reason I called it that was simply because there's been so much done about him. I think even within the last month, we've had two televised documentaries about his life. There's been histories. There's even been one recounting of many of his stories back from the 30s by a very famous anthropologist. But what was just missing in this was his voice. Mm-hmm. And what was missing in it was just the sound of his language, the sound of his spirit, his people. It was just all these external kinds of judgments placed upon him and the community he came from. And I guess I just wanted to do my best to represent what his voice would have sounded like.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I wanted to frame this. And also, too, I think what was really important was also framing for communities how important our oral histories are to our people and how important I think it is to look at story as a way of getting to know the past. And just as importantly, I think, getting to know our language. Where I come from, we're Ojibwe people. We don't necessarily call our language Ojibwe Mouin, as it's popularly called this side of the lakes. But we do call it Anishinaabe Mouin, the language of the people. And that's how we refer to it at home. And certainly for Francis, that was his first language, his primary language. And that was what I wanted to use to bring out the best parts of what we could possibly know about him through discourse with community.
So let's talk about how you came to these stories and who were some of the people you talked to.
One of my great uncles, in fact, my great uncle Duncan Pegamagabo, who was one of Francis's, you know, six sons, he was Francis's youngest son. And when all of his older brothers were off working or at school or, you know, doing different things, he spent all of his time with his father and just kind of you could just tell there was an incredible amount of love and memory and just connection between the two. And that's actually how I begin the book, is with the story called Ngizage Idimin. You know, we so loved each other. And it just describes that love they had. So when I became a little bit older and just started thinking, you know, this man really was very significant. And people don't know a lot about him, even though they know his name. You know, that name, Pegamagabo, it kind of fascinates people, just the name in itself. I started to ask elders in the community about his life. And at the time, his two youngest children were still alive. So I had a great uncle and a great aunt alive. And I used to ask them questions about him and his family and, you know, where they had come from. And what I had just loved about that was when I would go visit them, you know, I'd always take them tobacco. And as I should, I would say, you know, mi ma ba se ma, and daga nao dap in the maushin. Just ask them to accept this tobacco. And, well, you know, of course, which is something we need to do to ask a question to show the sincerity of our intention. I kind of expected that would be the extent of it. And they would say, oh, okay, you know, thank you, Brian. And okay, well, yeah, you want to know about our dad. And that never happened. And they were both very good speakers of English. They had gone to English school their whole life. They spoke English, certainly as well as you or I do. But then they would begin, Hausa, me il wat da baja moka on day dim. Miko gapamad ziti te wasaksing. Miko gayawin ga gitche shimaga nishuit. And they would begin, you know, this is a narrative about my father. You know, he was a man of this First Nation here. He had been a great soldier. And then they began to talk about just elements of his life. You know, that's what they would say. Miga onje bimadzid. This was the way that he had lived. And they talk about his character. And always it was, you know, these wonderful stories of how kind he was, how gentle he was, which was a huge contrast to everything I was reading about him, of the fierce, unrelenting, cold sniper who gunned down 400 people. And I'm thinking, you know, who was this guy that they were telling me about? And or conversely, you'd read these fierce letters he had with, you know, early Department of Indian Affairs Bureau chiefs or agents. And you know, I guess we have the Idle No More movement, which seems to have flared up in Indian politics and modern day contemporary North American life. I mean, they seem to be going through their very first stage of that back then, where they were standing up, where they were going to Ottawa, to the capital for the first time, protesting and forming coalitions of national Indian governments. And that's very much what he was doing. But again, it was these stories of this very unrelenting, very brave, very well-spoken, never back down kind of guy. But then you'd hear from his kids in the community who were saying, wow, he was just a wonderful, kind, gentle man. But the thing about it was always those stories were in Ojibwe, all of them. And that kind of belied the experience I had with them. They were always wonderful auntie and uncle. But I think I just always remember them, you know, being very, you know, having a relationship in English. And all of a sudden I offer this tobacco and there's hours of Ojibwe discourse. And I'm sitting there and not always getting everything and sometimes confused, but so appreciative of the fact that in remembering their father, somehow they could only use Ojibwe to talk about his life.
This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunanida, a program of Ojibwe culture. Our guest today is UMD Professor Brian McGinnis, talking about his latest book project, Between the Lines, a biography of his great-grandfather, Francis Pegamagabo, an Ojibwe man decorated as a World War I soldier.
I was wondering if you could share one of these stories and we could maybe talk about it.
Oh, I would love to. Yeah. One of the stories I think that was really quite fascinating, and because people always wanted to know stories about the war. Francis himself very rarely talked about that. I think because, A, it just invoked such difficult memories. And, you know, for such a kind, peaceful, gentle man to go overseas and you know, become, as they say, this ruthless sniper who could just take out, you know, three people a week. It just seemed to be such a contrast to that person he truly was and the person he tried to become again after the war.
Right.
And I think for the most part was successful. I mean, he certainly never killed anybody after the war, but he certainly was not the same. But he actually did tell one story, and this was about the invisibility story that people had always wondered, how did he seem to be able to do all of these things? And, and like even other soldiers from the local battalion, when they returned, they would say, yeah, at moments he just seemed not even to be there. He just seemed to disappear. And this was one night I had visited with his youngest son, and he was telling me stories, and we had been talking for literally hours about different Ojibwe philosophies, and all of a sudden, you know, we were pretty much wrapped up, and he was tired, and I was tired, and my brain had pretty much been stretched in all these weird ways, and I was ready to go home, and then I was leaving, and he just said, ah, noshkegwa yo, And he just said, no, look at this, think about this, note this. And I had my $20 tape recorder still in my hand, so I just went record. I had just enough.
And this is the 90s, so it literally has tape in it. It's literally not digital, yep.
This is a tape cassette. But this old man, so he stopped. Oh, no shkegwa yo. Now note this, he said to me, and he just kind of, he just said, gawindamon, gabim on de bejik. I'll tell you one more of these things. One more thing I want to tell you. So I came back in and sat down, and he was in his armchair. And it was almost like his preface for the story was this. He said, you know, me il abadek jajebwe wenaman yo nishnabe bimatsuin gishben debwe wenziwan kada nakimakasnon. And he said, so what he basically said to me was, you have to really believe in the Indian way of life, in the Indian way of thinking, because if you don't have faith, then not only will you not believe this, but this would not work. Mm-hmm. So I just sat there very quietly and just listened. Well, thank goodness I had hit record, because I did never want to forget this story. And he just said, you know, migaj websitya ao ma bum and dem gio migaza do de gichigaming. So this is something which happened to my father when he went to fight overseas. Gipskabi, which in Ojibwe means he returned home safely. And that was a big deal to be able to say, because so many mm-hmm. soldiers' families could not say that. And what he next said, it surprised me because he never talked about this. And he never talked about his father, you know, the soldier and what he did or what his deeds in war were like. And then he just shocked me when he just said, you know, Chijamakan ishawe, migunamaki gojinon no, ya an, biwabkun ga bakanagid, jonia wabkun ga bakanagejig. And what he had said to me was, you know, he was a great soldier in the war. And he came back decorated in all those many medals you would see hanging on his shirt, those silver medals that soldiers won for their deeds in war. And my eyes, I think, went really big because I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be a war story. This is what I never expected to hear. And then all of a sudden, he kind of changed focus and actually began narrating. And this is what he had said to me was, Midash mabam bejika nishnabe, ashko gewin ginen daguse jejimaga nishuit, ashko migading guna mishminwa wede bejiki migading yo. So it was at this time in history when there was this other Anishinaabe man, this other Indian man who was now being expected to go and fight in the war, for this was now the beginning of World War II, and my father was long at home, recovering from First War I. Mitashmabam gijado de gijimaganishiwit the aonde dem, for my father had gone overseas and been a soldier himself in the First World War, but this man, from a different community, it was now his turn to go overseas and do what my father had done. Mishkona ashko besho ashko witakamid zegze wijado de wenjimigading. So it was now getting close to the time when this man would have to cross the ocean himself, but he was afraid to go to war. Mitashki mikweni magwen nioya an Francis Pegamagabo. Ah, ngowe wa mao kitawitaksa. But he remembered about hearing about Francis Pegamagabo. Oh, I will go and see him, he must have said. And he thought to himself, Ash gajichigegwenyo, gipskabid. What must he have done in order to come back home safely to his family? Ogiwab magwen mio, giwen egutyo. So he himself went to see Francis to hear about this. Mio gawindamawad. And so he said to Francis, Miajgo majayan. And so it is now time for me to leave to war. But he also said to him, Ingutachdash gunamangujengo obstacus. I am so afraid, though, for it is likely I will be shot and killed somewhere over there, and never again will I see my family or community. Ashdashkin gajichigen yo gapipskabian. So what was it that you did in order to make it back home safely? And so it was that Francis thought about what he was asked. Migiwe egutio. And this is what he must have said to him. Aha. Gishpen ashgoe ninaman yo, gego ijewebsian. Gunamangana gego ashgo gutajian, ashgo we nisagoyan, batina wako shmaganishug, and gutajian we nisagoyan. So this is what Francis said to the soldier. Well then, if you're already thinking this way, that something's going to happen to you, then something most surely will. If you're already afraid of being killed when you're amongst all of those soldiers, then your fear is what will get you killed. But then Francis said to him, Mi dash iu inind. Mi ge aje ayayin. Bokwak bedun ayaan. Tikwans. E ba teko tikwans. Mishke shashagwin the manyo. So when you are there, break apart a branch, a dry dead branch, and chew on it a little while. Kashko agondazinyo. Wiyashega agonemen agonenemanyo. You're not to swallow this, but keep this in your mouth. Mi geon jejabwin. And you too will be able to pass through the lines. Migo geget ka jichiged ashko zexit. Ashko giwab nanguda. So this is what he did, this man who had been so afraid, now that he had seen what to do. Gonna bachin sugoyan and I'm a dub. Kidogwa. Gime kwenimad no ga gutio. Gibok bedotio tukwan se batenik. So one day in the war, this man who had gone overseas at this time said to himself, I'm likely going to get killed sitting here during a time of fierce battle. And he thought this one day during the war, and as he was thinking this, he remembered what Francis had said to him about how he was to find and break apart a dry dead branch. Gisha shagwendun giwan gisha buid. And he chewed on this and was able then to pass through the enemy lines unseen. Gawin gibashke gaza si. And he did not get shot. He did not get killed, and he passed right through. So you see, he was able to pass through those enemy lines and made it back safely. And he was so happy after the war to have made it back home. Me sa enenamug ma bum Francis, kidot. Ma bum Francis. It was because I thought of this man, he said, this man named Francis Pegamagabo. So upon returning from the war, he went to visit my great-grandfather. And he said to him when he made it to his house, Gawi ningi nisadota zinyo, namansh ganje jien, migiwa enat nyo. I don't really understand what you said to me, he said later to Francis. Ash ganje jien yo, geni ningi pskabi. What was the meaning behind those words? For I was able to make it back safely. I did what you said. Anindash gaun jejienyo, jagonenematyo. So what was the meaning behind the branch you told me to keep in my mouth? And minwa gogi na nagatawen dangaya, Francis. So Francis thought about this for a little while, and finally in good time answered him, Gamapi gogi na kwetawad. Kashkana gagawab nzinyo, gane bomagok mitagonskiwe. He said, well, it's very simple, he said to him. You cannot see a dead thing, such as a stick. Mimanda Anishinaabe Wadziwin. This is the way we believe in our Anishinaabe life and thought and spirituality. That in doing what you did, you took its state. Your body did, and the soldiers could not see you. And then what my uncle then looked right at me and just said, Minwage o we dapna manyo mashkike. Abde kdebwe wendanyo. And he just looked at me just point blank, and I don't know if my mouth was a little bit open at this point, but he just said, and you too, you have to believe in this, for if you did not, he said, this is the way, it's like it is when you take medicine, when you pick up medicine, you have to believe in it, because if you don't believe in it, this would not work. And then he just kind of sat back in his chair, and like many Ojibwe do, just kind of gave this big meow. Just mew, and that's it. And I just gave a miigwech, thank you. And I hit stop and just left and drove back to my home very, very happy to have heard something I never expected to hear.
This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunanada, a program of Ojibwe culture. Our guest today is UMD Professor Brian McGinnis, talking about his latest book project, Between the Lines, a biography of his great-grandfather, Francis Pegamagabo, an Ojibwe man decorated as a World War I soldier.
And this, I guess, again, just sort of reflecting back to the title of the book, which I'm calling Between the Lines, of course, Francis had his own way of getting between the lines, which was much more treacherous than the journey I've had in this of moving between lines. But even more modern accounts have at times surprised me. And a friend of mine who has just done a beautiful, I guess, more linear recounting of his history and his life story. And he has done an immaculate job. It's done by the author Adrian Hayes, who's a journalist and a historian and quite a wonderful writer, actually. And I've so enjoyed my conversations with him just about the facts and tracing through things. But in the last chapter of his book, you know, one of the things when Francis came back from war is like so many of our veterans, they come back, you know, traumatized from the experience, maybe mm-hmm. things they've seen, things they've done. In fact, one of the things I'll just quickly mention is, you know, Francis, when he was very young, just the family he came from, even his last name, Bebagamigabo, was the original. And it was to do with a great standing hurricane, tornado-like wind that would come and then retract and then come and retract in all of its power, but just kind of never really touching down. That was the name of his great-grandfather, and that was adopted as the family surname after that, with his grandfather and then so down. But one of the things with all of that, you know, he always had an affinity for storms and loved them and loved the sound of them. In fact, one of the stories in the book is all about how he would always honor the thunders when they would come in. But as life went on, as you know, this PTSD, as we know today, sort of began to affect him, the rumbling of thunder he began to associate with the rumbling of war and fighting. And he became very traumatized by that as he got older. And he would often run into the woods or run down the road. And people in the community began to just consider he would go crazy in these moments, is what they would say. And that kind of became this urban legend that he was this wonderful together man who would just sometimes absolutely lose it. And perhaps so, I don't know. But it was interesting, Adrian's book, he recounted a little bit of that, you know, that running away from storms and from thunder. And he said, he must have gone crazy because I've got this letter that, you know, he has written here home to his family. And in it, it basically says, Adrian says it's proof of the fact he was going crazy. And because what he says is it was, you know, his commanding officer in the war. And this was the time when chlorine gases and other very dangerous things were being used, were being used on the battalion. And they knew that was happening. And I guess there was this ominous advance of it. And his commanding officer had said to him, okay, Peg. And this is what Francis wrote in his letter. Okay, Peg, what can you do about this? And so I said to him, oh, I can look after this. We just need the wind. And the officer said, okay, well, you go for it. And then, of course, Francis didn't speak English well, so his writing isn't the most elegant. But he said, so I called on them, and they came, and they blew the wind back, and we were safe, and my boss was happy with me and smiled a lot. And so basically when this was read, this letter, you know, Adrian kind of looked at that and said, oh, wow, he really was crazy talking about wind and changing air. And as it was, it was one thing Francis talked about to his son. And for Ojibwe of that era, who were so spiritual, so connected to the world, so connected to the universe, that, you know, knew how to pray, knew how to talk to those wind spirits, Francis was able to call the wind to shift directions, which for the old Indians living on Georgian Bay, where, you know, the way the wind blew kind of meant your safety sometimes, you had to know how to do that. And that was one thing he had learned growing up. So he found that was able to work there too. The spirit still listened to that voice and that kind of petition. So he invoked the wind to shift direction, and it did, and saved his battalion once again. So what actually was interpreted as an act of craziness is actually just evidence of the continuity of his Ojibwe belief and faith and how that seemed to work even in that place, which is kind of an interesting reflective point that somehow, even throughout the war, there still was the spirit there. Francis himself, it was such a fascinating life that he had right from the get-go, and tragic life. You know, the old Indian stories were that his grandfather and father had been killed by witchcraft or sorcery, and that his whole family had died out, and that he was found as a baby on an island, just barely alive with his parents both killed. And he was raised by a different family on a different reservation. And that he was the only one who could survive. It almost was like this, I don't know, made me think of this Harry Potter story or something like that, seemed to survive the Dark Mark and, you know, continued throughout his life and in a very strong way. And he did many wonderful and beautiful things. And after the war, you know, when he came back and tried to integrate back into society, he found he was just treated like an Indian. He had been this, you know, done all these wonderful things and had really received no special recognition. In fact, quite the opposite. And he began to look around and just see how poorly his community was being treated and just realized this was absolutely not right. And so, like many people of that day, began to ask questions and say, well, why do we have to have our lives so regulated, so controlled? That they began to organize and, they formed actually the first what would become the first national Aboriginal political organizations. And Francis, during his later life, actually became the what they called the Supreme Chief of the, you know, National Indian Government, which later became the National Indian Brotherhood, and later would, you know, merge into an organization which we now today know as, you know, the Assembly of First Nations, the AFN, which is our national political group in Canada. But so his life after the war became all about fighting a new war. And that was that war for Indian rights and Indian lands and Indian sovereignty. And that was the fight he fought right up until the time of his death. But it was not an easy life post-war. You know, certainly he was almost looked down upon by people of his community in many ways. He, you know, all of his accomplishments seemed to mean very little. And he struggled with that, of course, too. He felt like he had contributed something very substantial.
So within kind of greater mainstream society, I mean, we were familiar with that story, but you're also suggesting then also within the community he had some issues.
Oh, very much so. Huh. Yeah, the community didn't understand what he had been through, didn't understand the trauma he had faced. And he also came, and he was such a different kind of individual. Like when he had first been elected chief, when he got back, he had been elected chief, and he had all these ideas to bring in all these elders into the old story house and narrate in Ojibwe, you know, all the old customs that the Bajmoanun, the Atsukanan, the legends, the stories of the people. And in that day, people were being so influenced by what was progress that they looked at that as being a step back into history. And so he didn't last long in office.
That's interesting.
But later in his life, he just... you know, it was difficult. You know, he suffered from gas poisoning, and his lungs began to give out. But I think for him, what I found just so wonderful was, and I think for many, for anyone we can hope for, that as, you know, he died back in 52, his grandchildren were all just beginning to be born. And his life was surrounded by that. In fact, my favorite stories were, none of these are in the book, but were of him in his gardens with his grand, his, you know, four small grandchildren from different families helping him garden and, you know, just playing with them. And it just, it seemed to be the kind of final days as, well, I guess grandparents we'd all hope for. And, but, you know, he couldn't, he had to sleep sitting up in a chair. And there was a very interesting story, and it's kind of in the epilogue to this of, you know, the night when he died. And I don't know if that was just this old Indian thing, but his children were, they actually, he had been coughing. And through the floorboards of their house, and there wasn't any electricity in that house at that time, they noticed light. There was a bright light through the floorboards. And they went downstairs, and their father, they said, had passed away then. But they always wondered, what was that light? What made that room grow so bright that it woke us up through the floorboards? And they went downstairs, and their father had passed away. So, there's a beautiful story, too, in there. It's one of my favorite. It's called Ndedemga Kiwid, When My Father Went Home. But it talks about Francis's final journey to the spirit realm. And it's one of my absolute favorite. And I would have to say, you'd have to look at the book to see that one, which hopefully will be released this fall.
That's all the time we have today. I want to thank our guest Brian McGinnis for sharing his stories with us. This is Ojibwe Stories, Gaganunanida. I'm your host, Eric Reddix. To listen again to past episodes of the program, visit the KUMD website at kumd.org and click on Audio Archives. Check out our Facebook page, Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanida, for updates and program schedule. Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanida is produced by KUMD and by the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth, home of the Master of Tribal Administration and Governance, or MTAG program, where students learn about leadership, law, sovereignty, and management from a tribal perspective. MTAG was designed by tribes for tribes. Accepting applications for fall 2014 semester now through August. More information at umdmtag.org. Funding for Ojibwe Stories Gaganunanida is provided in part by the UMD College of Education and Human Service Professions and by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.